Welcome. I'm Anna Ginja, your host of The Anna Ginja Show. I'm an international adoptee who has experienced the pain of rejection and the peace that comes with self-discovery and acceptance. Along the way, I've discovered that I am not alone. In some ways, we are all adopted into or out of homes, cultures, communities, and relationships as we grow and evolve. These experiences create who we are and who we are yet to be. So let's discover how we can be and become our best selves by connecting to the guest and creative content cradled in the belief that we belong, that we are worthy, and that we are loved in this world. So stay tuned and you may discover your own adoption story. So Marianne, I want to welcome you. We have Marianne Matthews-Clark, who is our guest today. But let me first start with thanking you for giving me your copy of the book. And we're going to talk more about this book. But when I opened it to the first page, there was a note written in 1999 that read, a handwritten note that read, "Dear Dad, you gave me a love of words and stories. This story I dedicate to you. Love, Marianne." So can you tell us a little bit about this as a way to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yes. I grew up in a small town of Mist, Oregon, population 50, with a two-room school and a valley store. My father had gone through the 10th grade, had an amazing memory, and could recite dozens and dozens of poems. And he was the valley poet. He wrote logging poems and often was asked to write poems for special occasions like neighbors' anniversaries and birthdays. He wrote a poem that hung over the doors of the Mist store for decades. The poem talked about the world events that had gone on during the time those doors had let the people in and out for years and years. And it ended with the line, "And still the best people in the world passed through these doors." One of the best compliments I ever received was when I was about 5. I overheard a teacher tell my mother, "Marianne's creative like her father." It planted a seed that I too might have a little tiny gift of creativity. And I just love my dad and appreciate him and am amazed by him.
Well, I am so honored that you gave me your copy of this book with that personal component of the book. And so I just appreciate so much that you would share that book with me. And I think your dad is very, very proud of you because you are an amazing writer. I was saying before the show that we met because of my high school English teacher who believed in me and all my creative endeavors too, which led to this podcast ultimately. So we have a lot of connections, Marianne, you and me.
Yes, we do.
So you gave me this book because of a reason, because you knew that I was doing this podcast that focused on foster care and adoption stories. So how did you come? Tell us a little bit about the story that you gave to me in this book.
Well, I've been working on a story about my foster sister who lived with us for 3 years. I've been working on it for a very long time. In fact, I was in the writing program in Iowa City and took a revision class, and I kept revising this story over and over and over, and I could just never get it right. I always had it through the point of view of the girl who was in the family where the sister came to. And so I couldn't pin it down. I just kept changing points of view. And finally, after the class was over, I decided to write it in the foster sister's point of view. And so I was able to finally write it.
Well, what's amazing is that Jane Smiley, who I just got through, amazingly enough, just finished her book last year. And there was an opera that was based on the book that she wrote. So the class was with Jane Smiley, right?
It was. Yeah, it was a revision class. It was one of the best classes I took in the program because we just kept changing and changing and changing the story until hopefully at the end it was finished. But mine just got more and more and more confusing until later when I put it in the foster sister's point of view. But the class was amazing. She was a really good teacher.
Yes. And do you remember anything particular about Jane Smiley at all? That little personal connection?
The only thing I remember is that she would ask us questions that were really astute. And the other story that I wrote for the class was about kind of a naive, or it was about a man who kept making mistakes. And she said, if you have somebody, I think he apologized a lot. And she said, if you have somebody who apologizes a lot, it can make them look foolish. If they just apologize a few times, that can make them look kind of humble. And she said, do you want him to be foolish or humble? She could ask the kind of question that I wouldn't have thought to even think about in the story. She didn't tell me I had to do it one way or the other, but of course I wanted him to look like a nice person. And so I took out some of those apologies. I just thought she was amazing.
That's great. So for those of you who don't know, Jane Smiley wrote the book, A Thousand Acres, that was based on I'm just drawing a blank. You're going to have to help me out, Marion, but also based in Iowa. And A Thousand Acres made into an opera. And so so what am I forgetting here, Marion? I need your help.
I think it was kind of a Shakespeare thing.
Yes, King Lear. Oh my gosh, tell Madeline Kelly, my high school English teacher, who we both know, I could not remember King Lear. For goodness gracious, great balls of fire. Let's quickly
move
on.
And I didn't either. I just said a Shakespeare thing, so that was...
We'll just blip this out for Madeline Kelly, my high school teacher, and our mutual friend. Now, so just going back to the story, moving forward. So just for the time being, is a fictional story. This is the short story that is contained in this book. So what's the real story behind the story and any memorable moments rooted in personal experience that you could share with us?
Well, it was really about my foster sister, Judy, who came to live with us for 3 years. My mother was a teacher, and my folks wanted to have more children, but my mother had 3 miscarriages and me, and it didn't look like they were going to have any more, and she wanted to adopt for their sake and for my sake. She wanted me to have a sister. So she was a teacher, and there she heard of a family in town who the kids were going to be in foster care for a while. And parents had to not go to jail for a year before they could get the kids back. So she came to live with us for 3 years. Judy did. She was 7 and I was 8. My folks didn't tell me that she may have to go back because they didn't want me to be up in the air all the time, you know, worried that she was going to go back. But she was with us for 3 years. And during that time, we shared a room. We played a lot of pretends. My town where I grew up only had 50 people. So she and I, she was an amazing part of my life for those 3 years.
Yes. And so they say, write what you know. And so this is what you did.
Yeah.
So would you read an excerpt of your book? I mean, of your story?
Yes. This excerpt starts after Ruth has arrived at foster care, and she's eavesdropping on Mrs. Reynolds, who's on the phone with her sister. I rub my leg, and when Mrs. Reynolds lowers her voice, lean closer to the back of the door. The social worker said Ruth can't be bounced from pillar to post much more, so if the mother and her man friend don't straighten up, well, it's hard to tell what will happen. We're trying not to get our hopes up, but it would be nice for Shirley if something permanent would work out. We're so far from town, and she wants a sister so badly. I don't know why she's saying it could be permanent. I'm at the Reynolds's just for the time being. Mama promised. That's what I promised the twins, too, when we dropped them off at foster care at a foster home in Burley on the way to the Reynolds's. I don't like to think about Rachel clinging on to me so tight the social worker had to pry her hands loose. Rusty stood on the porch like a corpse, not even waving goodbye. You should have heard what happened to her just before she came, Mrs. Reynolds says. I hold my breath, waiting for her to mention the axe cut Carson put over Mama's eye, the reason I'm here in the first place. After we knew we had to leave, I told Mama we should take the twins and hide, not tell anybody where we are, especially Carson. But that made her cry. The better we are, she said, the quicker we'll all be together again. What are you doing? A voice says from behind me. I nearly jump out of my skin. It's Shirley, the one who told me the first 20 minutes I got here that she was my new sister. Nothing, I tell her. Are you hiding? I shrug. In my first letter home, I told Mama, the Reynoldses are all right, but their girl doesn't know straight up sometimes. I told her Shirley wanted to play pretend and paper dolls and talked about being sisters. I said, I don't want to be your sister. P.S. I don't have to, do I, Mama?
I love that. Thank you for reading that for our listeners, Marion, and they can read that book. We'll make sure that they get information about how they can read the complete story. But as you read that and listen to the story, how does it make you feel and what does it connect you to, Marion?
Well, the story was in the growing section, mm-hmm. and I will just talk about, and I think that was a good section for it to be in, because I'll mention Judy and me. I felt like that we changed over time, and I think in the story, the two characters did change too. Ruth, the girl who was in foster care, wanted to go home at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And at the end, she feels safe where she is. And Shirley wants her to stay always. And so that's kind of how it was when my foster sister came. I think she really missed her brother and sister who were in another foster care place over the mountain from us. And when they came to visit, she would get really, really sad. And I didn't like it that she was so sad, because it seemed like she missed them so much.
Yeah. Well, I know, and as you were saying, you thought the piece was included in the section called Growing, and these pieces reflect the many ways in which adoption affects children from their perspective as well as that of the parents. And you had just mentioned about how from the story from the beginning, where she really doesn't want to say, even the language of how she starts to refer to the foster mother changes throughout the story, and you can see the slow connection to this family, and that she's, you know, becoming more and more close to the family, and you can feel that. It's very well done, very subtle, but very emotionally draws you into the story, into her story, that's for sure.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I think you talked about, I love the part where she talks about Shirley not knowing how to, always wanting to play pretend and not knowing how to be straight up. So the way that Ruth has been raised is really, she has to grow up pretty quickly because of the circumstances of her mother and her, Carson. So the part where they're trying to make believe, or Shirley's trying to force her to make believe, why did you put that into the story?
You mean later in the story, or something that I just read here?
Yeah, because I know that you wrote that Ruth is just so mystified by Shirley's wanting to play pretend.
Oh, okay.
And says rhymes when Ruth's gotten used to watching for clues that she and her brother and sister need to run for it. She's always had to face this reality. But then Shirley's trying to get her to play pretend, like all these things that normal kids do, but that Ruth just
right.
can't understand.
Yeah, Shirley is has grown up in this community with really no other kids around. I mean, you know, relatives come and visit and that kind of thing. But so when Ruth comes, she really grabs onto her, and Shirley has kind of learned to imagine a lot of things, play by herself and come up with little stories that she's in. But when Ruth comes, then, of course, she makes up stories for both of them to be in. They go to the creek and they you know, catch crawdads and they pretend they're pioneer woman. And Ruth really isn't used to that. She's used to, like you say, having to live in reality and watch out for Carson in case has his axe and they have to run if he gets drunk. So it's a really different kind of situation.
Yeah, and I'm going to connect it back to your situation in which that you played a lot of pretends with Judy, right? Because that was your thing?
We did, yes. And she would go along with that. You know, sometimes I could tell she wasn't exactly excited about it, but she would do that for me to make up characters that we would be, and then we would My grandma had a lot of old dresses in her attic, so we would put those on and go down to the creek and pretend like we were pioneer women, you know, churning butter, take a stick and stick it down in the creek bank and that sort of thing. So yeah. I finally had a companion in that.
Yes. And so did you guys ever get into trouble?
Well, we did. Once in a while we did. I think I maybe had a little jealousy going once in a while. I mean, it was an adjustment for both of us. But I remember once I got kind of jealous of the folks, I think, and having a sister that I thought my parents loved. And so we had done something and we usually shared a bedroom, but one night mom put us in separate bedrooms because we'd been arguing or something had been going on. And so when mom came in to say goodnight, I said, "I think that you love Judy more than you do me." And she said, "We adopted you," or not adopted, but we wanted Judy to come here. We chose Judy to come here and we love her and you're our own and we love you. And I said, "I'm going to tell her that you love me more." And she said, "If that makes you feel good, you go right ahead." And she walked out of the room. Well, of course, I never told Judy that because it didn't make me feel good.
That's a wise mom.
Yeah, I thought she handled that well. And I think probably, you know, I had little moments of jealousy. I'd been the only child for 8 years. What I was really jealous of, though, was when Judy's brother and sister from the foster home that they were in came to visit. And I could tell that she just missed them so terribly when they left. That was really hard for me.
Yeah, because that connection.
You know, I wanted her to like me more. But of course, she had taken care of them a lot. Mm-hmm. They were younger.
Yeah, all those connections and those ways that we want to feel that we belong and that we matter, right? And those relationships that are either biological or connected in other ways, like adoption and foster care.
Right.
So, Marianne, I'm going to ask you, too, would you read an excerpt that's your favorite part of the story?
Okay. "After 2 weeks, I get my first letter from Mama. I miss you so much," she says, then says that Carson loves everybody, but gets upset because he's been out of work. She might be right. When Carson first came to live with us in Boise, he was working for Orida. We ate lots of free French fries, and he used to bring Mama bottles of Charlie. That's her favorite. Once he brought the twins squirt guns and me a slingshot, but he hasn't done anything like that for months. In the P.S. part of her letter, Mama says, "Carson thinks he's onto a job managing a Wendy's. Things are looking up. We'll be back together before you know it. I love you more than anything." My stomach loosens up for the first time since I've been here. I tuck the letter in the corner of the top drawer of my chest of drawers. When I moved into Shirley's room, Mrs. Reynolds said, "Ruth, this is your bed, and that's your chest of drawers over there. We'll put all your underwear in one drawer, and pajamas in another, and shorts in another." I didn't have pajamas and only two pair of underpants and no shorts to my name. At Mama's, all of us, even Carson, put our things together in boxes. Once, Rusty dropped his paint box into our clothes without putting the lid on it. Carson's work shirt looked like a rainbow, which got him really mad. But most of the time, putting things together worked fine. At the Reynolds's, people have drawers and closets and shelves full of all kinds of things. "We have a place for everything and try to keep everything in its place, honey," Mrs. Reynolds said the day I unpacked. "That way you can find something when you want it," Shirley said, pulling my top drawer open and moving closer to look into my bag. "We need to step back to give Ruth room to unpack, honey," Mrs. Reynolds said to her. I stuck my winter jacket in one drawer, my underpants and jeans in the next, and my tennis shoes in the third. I was wearing my dress and good shoes. "I'll use the last drawer for the twins when they come," I said. "Shoes don't go in the drawer," Shirley said. "We'll put them in the closet," Mrs. Reynolds said, and lifted them out. Moving into a new place takes getting used to. She gave me a hug, the first one since I'd left Mama and the twins, and I wasn't sure what to do. Shirley looked really startled, too. She followed Mr. and Mrs. Reynolds around the rest of the night, asking if there was anything she could do to help. the way Mama does with Carson after they've had a fight.
Thank you, Marion, for reading your piece of the story. Can you tell us why you selected that piece as one of your favorite parts of the story?
I think it was just probably shows the difference in the two girls' lives, what Shirley was used to and what Ruth was used to, and Mrs. Reynolds trying to give Ruth some space.
Yes. So I want to ask you too, Marion. So when the story ends, and when Ruth left and went back to her family, what were the consequences to her, to Shirley and the family, or to you and your parents?
In the story, we just see both Ruth and Shirley before they actually go back. But we do see that Shirley has a moment, and I hadn't remembered this from the story until I reread it, when after she finds out that Ruth's going to have to go back, she says to Ruth, "I'm going down to the creek by myself." And I thought, okay, that's her way of separating and saying, okay, I can be by myself. And for Ruth, when she's packing to go, she fantasizes that maybe she can hide under the house, but she knows people always find you. Or she thinks maybe she could do a pretend. She's kind of caught on to these pretends and end up in China with her doll where no one can find her. So I think both of them at the end are struggling with the adjustment that they're going to have to make. And I don't think in the story they see each other's sadness. It doesn't show that in the story. And the consequence for me was, like with Shirley and Ruth in the story, I've kind of realized going through this process with you and writing these things down that I don't think we really had, Judy and I really didn't have closure either. We got 2 weeks' notice, and so we were, you know, helping her pack and that kind of thing. But I never thought to ask her the question, are you going to miss me? I think because I knew she had a brother and sister waiting. In fact, the day she left, Miss Klein came with her brother and sister. She had already picked them up, and Mom and Dad, you know, waved goodbye to Judy, and then Mom went into the house and Dad went to his shop, and I stood in the driveway, and Judy didn't cry. She was really glad to see her brother and sister, and I cried. But we were kind of a family that was a stiff upper lip family, and I don't blame my parents for that. They were trying to be strong and brave for me. I just think that when you don't have a time to really process that you miss somebody, you feel like you're doing it wrong if you feel like what it seems like other people aren't feeling. I did find out later in Mom's diary, she wrote that the night before Judy left, my mom had been in the house and thrown up, and that isn't like her. And I know they missed her terribly. We just didn't talk about it. Mm. And I also saw in her diary later that she had written, "Marion's lost." So they weren't oblivious to that, to my struggles. And at one point did ask, because I hesitated before I'd go upstairs to bed every night. And Mother asked me if I was kind of afraid to go up there by myself because the folks' bedroom was downstairs and Judy and I had slept upstairs, and I said I was. So my folks moved up to another bedroom upstairs. So I think they did what they could. And we've stayed in touch. We stayed in touch for quite a few years, and then we lost touch, but then we were in touch. We reconnected, and Judy and her family came many times to every summer, in fact, when I was out there to visit my folks, they would drive from Idaho where they lived. And Judy went to college. She was a supervisor at an Orida plant, and she and her husband raised five children. She's amazing. And I will say, at Dad's funeral, Judy and Bill and the family were there, and I did tell her that I had missed her terribly when she left. And she said that she'd missed me too, and that her mother was always worried that she was going to want to come back and live with us.
So you kind of got some closure when you were in your 50s.
That was comforting for me.
Yes. And you're still in touch with her on birthday cards. She calls you sis?
She does. And I will say that her birthday's in 2 days. Mm. And I, on this birthday card that I just sent, I signed it sis. And I've never done that before. And I think it's because of this radio show and thinking about this again.
I love that. So I'm going to talk about this last paragraph of the preface in the whole entire book, which is the two co-authors and the people that wrote this put this book together, wrote, "Pain, questioning, and joy are the intrinsic to adoption as they are to life itself. Our common experience teaches us these tales and poems belong to each of us. Adoption and the stories that surround it is a crucible, a severe test. It tests by fire our ideas about identity, loss, family, belonging, or not, questions that burn in us all." So it's no wonder that your story, just for the time being, was included in this anthology. So anything you'd like to share with our listeners to do, what they can do to create a world where everyone can feel that they belong, that they matter, that they are loved?
To state the obvious, we're all different with unique gifts that we use to connect, to include, to show we care. So I guess I'd say, I've just been thinking about this lately, be open to connecting in ways you've never tried yet. Maybe use gifts you aren't aware of.
So a very big heartfelt thanks to you for sharing your story, both in your short story and your life story. A special thank you to Adam Rich with WOUB for engineering and editing today's program. Our subject matter expert is Dr. Melissa Rizzo, and our storytelling producer and engineer is Zoe Lambert. Our music producer is Nick Krasernis, who's been writing genre-twisting songs for over 30 years, including this show's theme song, Way to Me. And I am your host, Anna Jinja, signing off with a reminder that the key to unlocking all things good in this world is love. And here you are loved and you are home. Always a friend and fan, this is Anna Jinja, wishing you days filled with love, laughter, and peace.